I know you've had some ups and downs in your life because of your interest in UFOs, because of the things you've said publicly about them. I thought for a while that you'd given up on the topic because it was just too hard on you and your family, but now I see you sort of bounced back. You're involved in online discussions on an ongoing basis. What happened? What's the deal with your personal life and your interest in the topic?
Well, there were several times that I kind of either took a break or said, I don't want to do this anymore, because it's so overwhelming when you realize what really is going on. It's so overwhelming that, you know, it's tough to take. So
it's depressing, isn't it?
Pardon?
It's depressing.
It's not depressing. Well, it's just, all I could say is it's overwhelming. So I took, a few months off, I think in 88 or 89, I can't remember. And then the airline that I worked for in July of 1989 called me in one day and they said, you don't actually believe this stuff, do you? And I said, yeah, as a matter of fact, I do. And they said, well, we can't have a captain flying passengers that believes in UFOs. So, you know, you need to find employment elsewhere. So they gave me 3 months pay and I went and started flying DC-8s, flying cargo out of Detroit, which was a lot of fun. You know, life has a way of working it out. I met a lot of good friends, and I kind of let the UFO thing drop for a few years. Then I took it up a little bit, but then I really didn't get back until like 2003 or 2004 when Art Bell called me up and he said, hey, why don't we do another show? And so about that time, they were talking about disclosure, and, I think that's probably, it's not that it's a ridiculous notion, it's just that it's never going to happen. So I had a few words to say about that, and I wrote the famous Lear disclosure briefing, and just, stayed in and out of it, and I'm back in it, and I am on this forum called AboveTopSecret.com, and we discuss all of this. And what's fun about being on AboveTopSecret.com is there's so many guys with so many different ideas, and you better be able to support yours because they will crucify you because they're so knowledgeable. I mean, there's guys that, that get on there and they really know what they're talking about. So if you can't back up what you're talking about, you're toast.
You mentioned that you don't believe disclosure is ever going to happen. You know, it seems like every other year or so, somebody comes out with a statement, oh, yeah, it's just around the corner. The good guys on MJ-12 want to spill the beans, but they're fighting with the bad guys in MJ-12. And any day now, it's going to come spilling out. And, of course, it never does.
No,
why do you suppose that it needs to be kept a secret? And maybe that goes to the center of your thesis that you released back there in 1987.
Yeah, it goes to the core that it's really none of our business. And people say, well, what do you mean? I got a right to know if there's aliens on Earth. Well, you really don't, because it's not about that. You need to just continue on your life, be a good guy, try and get rid of the bad things in your life, which are envy, hate, and greed, and just try and improve yourself. You don't need to know about what's going on in the background. Of course, some of us want to know. And, and if you want to know, I'll tell you. But it's not like there should be a mass briefing on CNN where they come on, the president comes on with his chief of staff and his joint chiefs of staff and says, aliens are here and, here's where they're from. That's never going to happen. It doesn't need to happen. Disclosure happens on a one-on-one basis. And that means that when you're ready to know, you will be told. And you won't be told by the government. You'll be told by someone else.
I know that a lot of people in our listening audience will find this frustrating, but I'll have to make an admission here myself, is that the longer I stay in the field and keep tabs on what's going on and do my own research, the less inclined I am to advocate for a complete disclosure. I agree with you completely that it's not going to happen. Perhaps for other reasons, perhaps because a lot of people would go to jail if they had to admit what they've been doing all this time. But also, I know that people think that they're ready. I know that they may be, in fact, ready for an idea that they're extraterrestrials. I'm not convinced that they're necessarily ready for what could be a very disturbing truth about the reality of life in our universe and on our planet.
You've nailed it exactly. As a matter of fact, I'm going to play that back and type it over because you just said exactly what I feel.
Why don't you give us a brief synopsis of what you came out with in the John Lear document? Because you talk about startling. There were a lot of startling things in there that really shook ufology down to its feet.
Well, you know, it's kind of hard to remember. I haven't read that thing in a long time, but basically I talked about what I found out in the year and a half before that, and it was basically that, yes, there was a cover-up. Yes, extraterrestrials are here, that a group named MJ-12 is dealing with them, that we have a lot of technology that we're trying to find out about. That there have been several agreements made. The agreements were, now, this is what I wrote in back then. It doesn't mean I necessarily believe it now, but what I wrote was the agreements were that in return for our permission to abduct a certain amount of humans, that the aliens would give us certain technology. There was also a little bit of the reports of the infamous Grudge 13 report, some of the gruesome UFO incidents that they had, and basically I ended up it wasn't a manifesto, but it was basically what I thought. And I said, if you ever see a flying saucer with beautiful green and yellow and blue lights, run like hell, because I didn't have anything else to say. Here's the hilarious thing. Whitley Strieber, who used to call me practically every night telling me about his experiences, when he read that, he called me up and he said, I read your thing. And I said, yeah. And he says, where you say run like hell? And I said, yeah. He says, where? I mean, that was just hilarious.
One of the things that you wrote in that that paper was that you said that on April 30th, 1964, the first communication between aliens and the U.S. government took place at Holloman Air Force Base in New Mexico. Three saucers landed at a prearranged area, and a meeting was held between the aliens and intelligence officers of the U.S. government. How do you know?
That was Bob Emenegger told me that, and he's the one that was approached in the 70s. He was part of Sandler Films, which was a CIA cutout, did their work, and they said, look, we're ready to release the story on UFOs. We're going to give you, and I think it was 10,000 feet of film of UFOs and that meeting and everything, and they said, we want you to tell the story. And that was the video that came out, UFOs Past, Present, and Future. But what happened is they made the movie and got everything ready, and at the last minute, they did have that footage, and at the last minute, the Pentagon said, no, there's been a change in plans. We don't want to do it. And so the video that you see on that's today is released, and there's several different names for it. That's why there's no conclusion in the end and no footage. I mean, that the story just ends. But that was supposed to be the release. And I've spent many hours with Robert Emenegger. He's retired now. I think he lives in the South somewhere. And he told me all about the briefing they got and about that Holloman meeting. Now, that wasn't really the first one. The first one was in 1954 at Edwards Air Force Base, which was then called Muroc Air Force Base. And that's when Eisenhower had the famous meeting with the aliens there that he supposedly went to the dentist. And that's where we've had so much of the documented material on that particular meeting. So there were several meetings.
We're going to take a short break, John. When we come back, I want to ask you about the suggestion that there was some sort of a treaty to allow aliens to abduct humans. Stick around, folks. I'm George Knapp, guest host here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp, your guest host. My guest this evening, John Lear. John, in the paper that you wrote back in December of 1987, one of the central points you made was that you believed, at least back then, that there had been some kind of a deal worked out between our military and these alien visitors that would allow them to abduct humans. Here's my question about that prospect, and I don't know if you still believe that to be the case or not, but I always wondered, well, if that were true, why did the aliens have to make a deal? Couldn't they just do it on their own, aren't they just still doing it on their own? Why would they need our permission if they're so technologically superior to us?
You're absolutely correct. There's no reason why would they have to make a deal with us. If they did, and I don't know that they did, it was a scam on their part. You know, maybe we had found out about the abductions, and they, in order to placate the military, they said, "Well, look, here's the deal. We just want to abduct a few. We'll give you the names and everything, and in return, we'll give you all this cool technology."
And do you believe that they lived up to that part of the bargain?
That the aliens?
Yeah, that they did give us the technology that perhaps was out at 51.
Lots of cool technology. It's the other part they didn't live up to. I mean, you know, everybody gets abducted. I thought, you know, in those days it was 1 in 10, but it's certainly more than that.
One of the other parts that you mentioned, you get into the stuff about Groom Lake in that paper back when. It was that was the my initial introduction to the possibility that alien technology had been tested and stored out there. This is prior to your involvement with Bob Lazar, right?
Right.
You wrote that you felt that the base had been closed down for a period between 72 and 74, and a huge underground facility was constructed out there, which is where this bargain for technology was set into place. Do you believe that to be the case still?
Yeah, there is certainly a huge underground facility there. Now, whether there's any current saucer technology there or not, I'm not sure. There is certainly aliens there in that underground area there.
That's a tough one to swallow, don't you think, for people in the audience? I mean, even people that are interested in the subject, that there could be aliens out there working at a base alongside our personnel?
Yeah, it sure is tough. And, you know, if they'd have been in my shoes for the last 20 years, talk to the people I talk to, you know, talk to the people, you know, that have walked down the corridors and told the stories of, you know, passing aliens. They believe as I do, but I don't blame them for not believing it, because just it's a tough story. I mean, you just cannot hardly, you know, grasp the fact that our military is working with aliens, and they probably, you know, they work with at least five to seven different species up there. It's not just one. There's all kinds of them up there. But that's how they keep the secret, is people just don't believe it.
You and I know a lot of people who've worked out there over the years in legitimate classified programs, SR-71, U-2, stealth fighter and stealth bomber and things like that. And people like that who have legitimate credentials who are up there, they say, that's a bunch of baloney. I never saw any flying saucers. What do you say to those folks? Is compartmentalization and up there so severe, so strict, that even people who work there wouldn't necessarily know about this stuff?
Absolutely. I would doubt that 99% of the people that work at Groom Lake don't know what's going on there. First of all, a lot of it's underground. Second of all, it's very compartmentalized. Yes, I know people who were heavily involved in projects up there and say, no, there's nothing like that. And I also know people who say, yeah, I saw those saucers around there all the time.
You know, you had this interest in the area, in flying saucers, and the possibility that saucers were up there. You put out this paper at the end of December of 1987, and then lo and behold, poof, along comes a guy who seems to confirm your worst fears or your wildest suspicions, that guy being Bob Lazar. And a lot of folks think, well, that's just too darn convenient.
It was extremely weird. What happened, as you remember, in the spring of 1988, I was on my soapbox, because at that time I didn't believe the military knew about this, and I wanted to tell the public about it. So I gave that lecture at the Spring Valley Library, I think 2 weeks in a row there, and I got a call in June or July from Gene Huff. And Gene says, hey, listen, I'm interested in your stuff, and I'd like to get a copy of your tapes and stuff like that. Well, about that was one of the times I had withdrawn, and I was getting so many calls, and it was just so overwhelming. I said, look, I'm out of it. I'm not going to have anything to do with it, and, you know, goodbye. And he said, well, okay, if you ever change your mind, he says, I'm a real estate appraiser, and I'll trade you an appraisal for your tapes. Well, that meant something to me, because I needed a loan, and I needed a second mortgage on my house. I said, okay, look, you do that, and I'll give you everything I have. So I started copying all my stuff and got it all ready for him. And we made a appointment. He comes over with this guy, and he says, I have my help here. We're going to measure your house. And we start talking. Turns out this guy's name is Bob Lazar. So as Gene and I are talking about saucers and Billy Myers and MJ-12 and all this stuff, this guy is rolling his eyes, and he can't make it plain enough that he thinks we're absolutely nuts. And so Gene says, look, this guy worked at Los Alamos National Labs. You know, he's a scientist. He was a scientist there. He thinks we're nuts because he said if there was anything there that he would have known about it. And then Bob says, yeah, look, he said, I had the highest clearance. He said, I was the nosiest. I poked around everywhere. He said, if there was anything to this, I would have known about it. You know, didn't we hear that from Ned Day? So anyway, over that was like in the June or July of 88. Over the next 3 or 4 months, we started giving Bob Lazar information, and he was receptive. He said, okay, well, I'll look at it. And one or two, I think there was three things that really tipped him over. And one was the YY-2 secret address that we had at Los Alamos, and the fact that we knew about it and he didn't. And the other was, I forget what the three things were. Oh, the grudge reports, he did find those that were not supposed to exist. And there was a third one, I forget what it was. But anyway, around October, he had decided to reenter the scientific community to find out if this was true. And that's when he called Dr. Teller at Lawrence Livermore in California and said, I want to reenter the scientific community. And Teller says, do you want to work there in Nevada or work here in California with me? And Bob said, I want to work at Area 51. And Teller says, let me see what I can do. That's when Bob got the three interviews at EG&G. And I even have a typewritten piece of paper of the second interview because he came over here. Because the first question on the second interview was, do you know John Lear and what do you think about John Lear? And Bob says, the way I answered that question was, yes, I know John Lear. And I think he sticks his nose into places where it doesn't belong. And Bob said, what I didn't tell them is I also like to stick my nose into places it doesn't belong.
You would think that that would be an automatic disqualifier for someone to work in a program out there, no matter what the program.
And that's why I've always had this secret fear that Bob was brought into the program, you know, as the first part of a disclosure of what was going on, and we were supposed to tell what was going on. There's so many little teeny hints. For instance, the first night he went there, December 6th, and he came back to my house and told me what was going on. I mean, you know, they followed him. I mean, and then when Bob was telling me about it, he said, I can't volunteer information, but I can answer your questions. And, you know, it was like it was a setup, and it's never been resolved in my mind whether or not, you know, it was a setup. Now, I know this, or I feel all the stuff he told me was true. So the question is, were they purposely trying to get this information out?
What did you think about him when you first met him? What was your impression of him as a person? Smart guy?
Smart guy. And, you know, he handed me his resume. His resume did have it was a 8.5 by 11 little folder. And it did have the MIT and the Caltech degrees in there. Now, I had that resume. I kept it. It disappeared. I can't explain why there's no records of his schooling. I can't explain why MIT doesn't have any records. I do know that he went to MIT when he was working in Los Alamos.
There are those who wonder if these two men were working with the government in some sort of a trial balloon, a psychological exercise to see whether or not a release of information about government knowledge of the ET reality might cause a panic. All those theories have floated around over the years. We're going to come back with John Lear in just a minute and ask him each one of those one by one, as well as his relationship with Lazar, how it developed, how this story unfolded, a story that is now known all over the world. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp, your guest host. My guest this evening, John Lear, the one and only. John, we've been talking about Area 51, Bob Lazar, how you two first met and how you sort of debriefed Bob about UFOs in general and the cover-up. You know, you've heard the theories that I just discussed in that previous to that break about all the things that have been said about you and about Bob and what you two were really up to over the years. Let's go through them. I'd like to give you the chance to answer some of these things. The fact that you guys were working in cahoots together to cook this whole thing up. What do you think?
Sounds good, but first I want you to say hello to my friends at AboveTopSecret.com.
Hello, friends at AboveTopSecret.com.
Thanks, George.
All right. Tell me about, you know, you've heard all those statements about you and Bob and who was playing whom and whether you're working in cahoots for the government and things of that sort. The idea that you created him, that you putting him up to this. Let's deal with that one first.
Well, I don't know how to answer that. I know nothing about physics. I wasn't the one that, that told us about gravity A and gravity B. Those are two real things. Bob Lazar gave us those. I don't think it's been released yet, but when scientists do release what gravity really is, and it does have nothing to do with gravitons, and there is two gravity waves, gravity A and gravity B, one works on an atomic scale and one works on a larger scale, I didn't invent that. Also, I didn't invent the element 115 and the properties and how it works and how it's stable at 115 but unstable at 116. And the reaction giving off the antimatter and the access to the gravity A wave, which allows travel, you know, at hundreds of times the speed of light. So I didn't, you know, Bob was the one that learned that up at S4. So
the idea that both of you did this as a disinformation plot to distract attention away from something else that was going on up there, I've heard that one more often in ufological circles over the years, and it seems to be the prevailing view among the UFO hierarchy that that it was a disinformation plan to distract attention from something else up there, which I've always thought that's, if that were the plan, that was a really stupid plan, because by saying they're flying saucers up there, it created an international sensation, drew tens of thousands of people. They're still going out there to look at whatever it is that's flying around out in the skies above central Nevada.
I agree.
And
I agree 100%. I mean, if it was a disinformation, they did the wrong thing.
You mentioned something a couple of minutes ago before the break that you said that in the back of your head, you've always had the thought that maybe you were played by Bob, that he really was working with them. I mean, how much credibility do you give that possibility?
No, what I meant to say was that I was being played by the people up at the test site through Bob. That they wanted the information released, and they used Bob to come to me because I was the UFO guy and was supposed to release it.
What could be the reason for something like that if that scenario were true? How does it make sense?
There was a lot of guys that wanted the information out, and when I first started this, George, I knew some guys, not particularly at Groom-like, but I knew some test site guys. I flew for Dynelectron, and I flew that B-26 and the OV-10 and the Huey and that Turbine Beach that was out there on Patrick, that old hangar they had out there on Patrick Lane. And I'd fly around there around the underground nuke tests. And what I do is my job is, depending on what airplane I was flying, was if the nuke test vented, we were supposed to pick up samples of it, you know, and bring it back. And one of the other things I did is before the nuke test, I'd fly around the outside perimeter of the test site and between 5,000 and 15,000 feet and take wind direction and speed and radio it down. And I knew a lot of the guys there. I also had a little gun shop called Special Weapons on there on Maryland Parkway and Trop. And a lot of the, you know, guys would drop in. Also, I knew the chief test pilot of Special Projects. He flew with me over in Laos. I knew a lot of those guys. So, you know, every once in a while, I'd get a little teeny tidbit of information. And that's why I thought that it might be something like that. There was another guy that hung around a lot. His name was Jerry Myers. And I met him through the Confederate Air Force. And he gave me a few tips. That was a really interesting little scenario that went on. But the most important thing, George, is during that time, and I'm talking about 87, 88, and part of 89, because it pretty much all stopped after the Lazar thing came about, people would come to my door. Now, I was an airline pilot, and I was away most of the time, but you know that I live here up on Sunrise, and people would come up and knock on the door, and my wife would answer it, and they'd say, I can't give you my name. I wanted to tell you that your husband is right, that I work up in those black areas. And I can't tell you how many times that happened. And people were trying to get the information out. So whether that was the story or not, I don't know. I know that there's been attempts to get the information out, that there are people that know that we were much further along in technology. Right now, we're 50 years ahead, and there's no reason why we can't have some of it, but it's not being done. So that's why I give credibility to some of those who say, well, maybe Lear and Lazar were used as conduits trying to get the information out. The only difference would be they call it disinformation, but it was real information.
You know, I think a lot of people, as I mentioned, in the UFO circles, certainly the UFO hierarchy, have dismissed the story. They no longer believe it. They're open to the idea that maybe we had some technology out there. They just don't want to believe Bob because of the problems in verifying his credentials and academic credentials in particular, work history, things like that. I tell them, you know, when we have conversations, look, I know it's a hard thing to swallow. It's a hard story to believe. It's much easier to dismiss it because of all the things that have happened. But you don't know because you didn't live through it. That was a weird time. There were some weird things that happened that shed light on the veracity of this story. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. You have nailed that. That time between 1987, 88, 89, the stuff that was going on in Vegas that you and I knew about, that girl that got murdered in her apartment over the Area 51 deal, remember that?
Yes.
Just stuff like that was going on continually. And, you know, for people who didn't live here, they didn't live through that, so they weren't involved in it on a day-to-day basis like you and I were.
For the thing about the credentials, you know, that's a problem that people have about Bob. And so many people have done the same steps that we did in the beginning and found out, well, he doesn't have any record at MIT or Caltech. They're not there. They find out the same thing later and think they've got a big expose or something, when in fact that information was presented in the very first story we aired about Bob. But explain to me how it would work that a guy like him could get hired up there. You know, it's question about what his clearances were. Even if you buy the idea that he went to MIT or Caltech, he's an interesting character with a lot of different kinds of interests. The interest in the legal brothel, the jet cars, the pirate flag that would fly on top of his house, the desert blast events, and making his own fireworks. I mean, you can see a lot of reasons why people would worry about having him work at a place like that, wouldn't you think?
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, one of the things when you hire into a program like that and you don't have a long history of being with the government, and they're going to upgrade you in a couple of months to the highest clearance level in the United States, one thing they want to make damn sure is that they have a way to discredit you instantly if anything goes wrong. They're going to make that brothel known. They're going to, you know, make the fact that you don't have any education credentials. They're going to have all that in place first. So if anything goes wrong, they can instantly dump you or discredit you.
Well, that's one of the things that people say. Well, if this program were true, they'd have scientist XYZ, because guys like that are much more credible than somebody like Bob. But in fact, when you look at it through that prism, Bob may have been the most qualified guy in the world for that program, because he's technically brilliant, you know, knows a lot about science, knows a lot about mechanics and electronics and things of that sort, but he certainly would be an easy target to discredit.
Absolutely. He had a broad education. He knew a lot of things about a lot of different things, and that's why when they went through the first, when they weren't the first two interviews, and then he got the third interview, they probably said, hey, this is the kind of guy we need up there.
Did he tell you right off the bat when he got hired, or did he wait a while?
No, the last thing I knew before he went up there was the second interview, and that's the stuff I have typed up when he came in and he said they wanted to know about you, and there was three or four other things. I wish I had that piece of paper, but I don't have it right there. He got a third interview that he didn't tell me about. Now, the first time he went up there was December 6th. Now, he has that on that, you know, that log he kept, you know, that calendar he always kept on his wall.
Right.
Every year, and he put, you know, that was the flight to nowhere. Well, I looked up in my logbook, and I was gone then. So it must have been either the second, time he went up there, because I don't have a record of when he first came up here, but it had to be like the 8th or 9th, maybe the second week in December. And that's when he came in the evening, like about 7 or 8 o'clock, and I'm sitting there, you know, writing checks or something, and I said, what's going on? And he said, I saw a disc today. And I thought I didn't hear him. I said, what? He said, I saw a disc today. And I said, theirs or ours? And he said, theirs. I said, you went to Area 51? And he said, yeah. I said, then what are you doing here? I said, why don't you learn what's going on up there? I said, they might have followed you here, and, you know, you won't get to go up there again. And here's exactly what Lazar said. He said, John, you have taken so much crap over the last year that I have seen that you deserve to know that it's true. I saw it. I touched it. They're real.
Well, in that sense, then he violated a security oath pretty early in the going.
Exactly. But the thing is, and, you know, and in part of that conversation, he said, I'm allowed to tell you, I'm not allowed to volunteer anything, but I can answer questions.
No kidding. So, and did he keep you appraised after subsequent events up there? Did he give you little briefings?
Yeah, he'd come over and tell me, for instance, you know, it's been told 100 million times, and I'll just tell it again. And the night, it was in January, and Irene, I know it was January, it was really cold. I had on a short sleeve shirt. He comes in. We no longer talked openly in my den because we knew it was being recorded somehow. And I forget what the story is like that, but he gave me the high sign. And so we walked outside. You know how my den has a back door and it goes by the pool. And you walk out by that back gate, you know, where the stable is.
Yes.
You know what I'm talking about, right?
Yes.
So Bob and I walk out there, and my wife is by the pool. He says, and she's always suspicious of what me and Bob are up to, you know, because we're always getting in trouble. So she says, where are you guys going? And I said, oh, we're just going to go out in the backyard for a second. So we went out that big wooden gate, and Bob stood right there, and he denies this, you know, to this day, but this is exactly what happened. This is exactly the way I remember it. His eyes were shining brightly. He was alive. He had something to tell me of great importance. And I said, what? And he said, John, you will never know what it's like to see your first live alien. I said, you saw it for sure? He said, yes. I said, it wasn't a doll or a puppet? No, I saw him. And then he told me, you know, he's walking down the hallway, guards on both sides. He comes by this door. There's a 12-inch by 12-inch window that has the wires through it. He looked through the window, and there's two scientists in lab coats facing him, with one of the grays facing away from him, talking to the guys in lab coats. Now, Bob denies his story this day. He says, you know, something like, well, I told John I saw something, and he said, oh, that's an alien, that's an alien. That's not the way it happened, George. The way it happened is the way I just told you. So that's fine if Bob wants to deny it. You know, I can understand why he would, having taken so much flack, but that's the truth as I remember it.
Then in March of 1989, you
March
take
21st
the...
March 21st is when he was making the doggy death ray. And the doggy death ray was my wife had some dogs, and we had just planted I had just made her a little Japanese garden, and they were digging up the garden. So Bob said, well, let me make a high-pitched tone so that it'll keep the dogs away. And we nicknamed it the doggy death ray. So that whole day, March 21st, we worked on this, or he worked on this little doggy death ray. It was just a little amplifier. And towards the end of the day, he said, they're going to test fly tomorrow. Do you want to go see it? And I said, test fly what? And he said, one of the saucers. And I said, yeah, how can we do it? And he said, there's a back road into Groom Lake, which I knew about because I'd already driven it. He said, we can go down that. I said, we can see it from there. And he said, yeah. And I said, how do you know it's going to be tomorrow night? And he said, it's always on Wednesday night, just at dusk. And I said, great. So the next night, Gene Huff and me and Bob, they showed up at my house because we were going to take my motorhome. And Jackie was with us. And we loaded up the motorhome. And I think we left, I think, about maybe 6 o'clock. We drove up Highway 15, got off at 93, went up 93, went through Alamo, turned left on 375, and we're just halfway up that summit when the transmission gave out. And Bob said, hey, you ever think about putting any transmission fluid in this? And I said, I don't think I have. So Gene Huff got out and hitchhiked back down to Alamo, got some transmission fluid, came back, we poured it in, and it worked. And we came up top of the hill. Now it was about it was about 8:30. And we drove down the Groom Lake Road, parked, and got all our stuff. And at 8:45 is when the light came up. Now, it's just a light. You couldn't see it was a saucer. It started jumping around the skies. And I'm trying to set up that 8-inch Celestron scope. And when I finally get it lined up, the saucer is descending behind the mountains. And I got a good, like, 15-second look at it as it's descending, and I've described it. It was a disc oriented about 30 degrees to the horizon. It was like flowing. Something was flowing it off in a gold or orange substance, and it was a flying saucer.